You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up later in the program, Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss shares his recommendations for great reads in the fantasy and science fiction realms.
First, we've got punctuation on the brain, from periods to quotation marks and everything in between. Punctuation plays a pretty big role in our everyday lives.
Our next guest found the stories behind our favorite punctuation marks and some lesser known ones as well. And the story of punctuation is closely intertwined, he found, with religion, technology, culture, and the age-old desire to accurately represent what we're trying to say.
Joining us now is the creator of the Shady Characters blog, Keith Houston. He's got a new book based on the blog called Shady Characters, The Secret Life of Punctuation, Symbols and Other Typographical Marks. Keith, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like you first got interested in this topic. You came across a pilcrow, which I had no idea what that was. In fact, it turned out I'd seen it. But tell us about this interesting pilcrow.
Yeah, the pilcrow it looks a bit like a P. The bowl of the P is filled in, and it's also reversed. It's sometimes called the reversed P. I was reading a book by an English sculptor and typographer who was called Eric Gill. During the time that he was alive, he was revered. He was a very popular respected figure in the English art world. But then after he died, it turned out he was actually a pretty reprehensible guy. So this book I find very interesting is about typography, and he had a very kind of arts and crafts sort of ethos running through it, with this pilcrow, this little paragraph mark peppered all the way through it. I didn't know what it was, so I read about it, and it seemed that there was so much story, there's so much history, in fact, behind this single character, going all the way back to basically before punctuation itself. And the project just sort of exploded from there, really.
So what do we know about the origins of punctuation, where it came from in the first place?
Well, it started off, it wasn't really for writers, it was for readers. So if you were an ancient Greek, let's say sort of Homer's time or after that, many centuries BC, you had no punctuation. The text was just, all the letters were crammed together. There were no spaces between words. There were no periods or exclamation marks. You had to pick out words and syllables as you read. So reading was often done aloud. And it turned out that readers then started to add marks. A librarian at the Library of Alexandria came up with a system of marks that said, basically, this is a short pause, this is a long pause, and this is a final pause. And these were points, which is where the term punctuation comes from. So basically, punctuation was invented to help readers. They would mark up their text so that when they read them back again, they had a better idea of the cadences, of the rhythm of the sentences. And it gradually was co-opted by writers, and more formal systems evolved, more symbols evolved as well. But that's where it started.
It's interesting that there is this trove of these old punctuation marks, and some of them have gone the way of the dinosaurs. They've just slipped away from us. Others have gone on to new lives. Tell us about one of your favorites that we may have overlooked.
There is a mark called the interrobang, which was invented by an advertising executive in the 1960s. It's a combination of a question mark and an exclamation mark. And he was sick of his copywriters putting these two marks together to signal a kind of an excited question or a rhetorical question. I think the best example is, who forgot to put gas in the car? you know exactly who forgot to put gas in the car, but it's a sort of an exclamation as much as a question. And so he thought, let's actually invent a mark, which is just a single symbol for this sort of usage. So he wrote a couple of magazine articles about it. He had his art director drop some designs. And it almost took off. I mean, incredibly, he basically just conjured this mark out of thin air. His name was Martin Spector. And within, I think it was 5 or 10 years, you could buy a typewriter with an interrobang key in it. You could buy a font if you wanted to print something with an interrobang in it. And it almost caught on. It was so close. You can type one on a computer if you know what you're doing. But it basically just kind of slipped away. It didn't quite reach the critical mass that a mark of punctuation needs to have in order to actually work. I actually ended up talking to the wife of this man, Martin K. Spector, in New York last year, and it was just amazing. It sounds a bit pompous perhaps, but it felt like being part of the story, actually being able to talk to this lovely woman about this this sort of invented mark of punctuation. So I think I'd have to say that's my favorite.
It's got a fantastic it's got a fantastic name, doesn't it? And I feel like with our modern, the way we text so often and in Twitter so often, people use excess punctuation, tons of exclamation points, couple question marks. You have to face it. The interrobang is more efficient, isn't it? Shouldn't we just bring this back?
Oh, Twitter should be promoting it. Absolutely. I think it makes quite a lot of sense. Also, perhaps another thing that might be useful is the concept of an irony mark. And people keep on trying to invent irony marks, and basically they try and they fail, and someone else tries and they fail. And we've been doing this for about 300 years, and I think that would make a huge difference, especially for online communication when you perhaps don't have many symbols or many characters to play with. And yet it never quite works.
Well, it seems like a natural, though, doesn't it? Because as you write about, the role of the punctuation is to try to precisely convey what we're trying to say. And irony is really hard to convey in an email sometimes and can cause much confusion and delay among people being ironic and sarcastic with each other. But can we make this happen? What would it take to make this catch on?
That's a very good question. The problem, I think, often boils down to the technology. Before we started printing things with computers, before we started communicating with computers, you had the typewriter. And so you were effectively constrained to what was on the typewriter keyboard. So some marks basically got squeezed out of existence. Before typewriters came along, we had lots of dashes. We had very short dashes, we had very long dashes, all kinds of dashes for different purposes. The typewriter has exactly one dash on it, which serves as a dash or a hyphen or any of these other sort of family of dashes. And to get a new key onto the typewriter keyboard was very difficult, hence why the interrobang didn't quite make it. And I think the same is true now. If it's not possible to type something absolutely trivially just by hitting one key on your computer keyboard, then I worry that there maybe isn't much chance for it. I mean, you know, technically it's feasible. There's nothing stopping us doing this, but I think it's perhaps technology. Plus, I'm not sure people want more punctuation in a sense. It feels like we have a fixed number of characters in our head that we can deal with, and I wonder if an extra one would just be too much.
How do you feel about emoticons? Are you a fan of the smiley face?
Yes, in as much as it's sometimes useful. It's sometimes useful for communicating irony or, you know, saying what I've just said is a joke. And it's recognizable. I mean, I wouldn't use it in a formal email or a formal letter or a book for that mark, for that matter. But I'd be quite happy using it in a tweet or a sort of a personal email.
One of my favorite history lessons in your book is the roots of the ampersand. Now, a lot of the things you talk about are from the brainiest people of their time, Cicero, or you said the librarian at the Library of Alexandria. Where did the ampersand, the symbol for and, come from?
Well, the first recorded ampersand was some graffiti on a wall in Pompeii. So someone had felt it necessary to write something. Unfortunately, the rest of the bit of graffiti is not recorded. But yeah, it was effectively just an E and a T, so the Latin word et or and. And somebody had written it a bit quickly, and the two kind of touched, the stem of the T touched one of the kind of the arms of the E. And that was basically the first ampersand. You can trace a sort of family tree pretty much from there all the way through to the ampersand that you might see printed in a book now.
And the ampersand for font makers seems to be their chance to cut loose. Even the boringest font out there, they really have fun with the ampersand a lot of the time.
Yeah, it is. It's very much a sort of canvas, as you say, to kind of cut loose. I think there's a fairly standard way that a typographer will approach setting a book or a website, and that is to use the best ampersand you have. It's actually, this is incredibly nerdy, it's quite a lot of fun to create an ampersand in Microsoft Word and just to sort of scroll down through different fonts to see what people have done with the ampersand. Some of them are very abstract. It's this sort of formalized ampersand we have now, which doesn't really look like et at all. And then some basically are the letters E and T kind of banged together in a slightly creative way. So it's very much maybe a little signature of the person who's designing a given font.
Well, one punctuation mark that's gone on to be a superstar in today's world, you wouldn't have known it by its ungainly name, Octothorpe. it's, I guess, another better known as the hashtag. Tell us a little bit about where that one came from.
Yeah, well, the mark and its name have two sort of separate origins. The mark itself, in America, you call it the pound sign, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. And it comes from the abbreviation LB for this meant Libra Pondo, which is Latin for pound in weight. And so people wrote LB and they would put a kind of a line through it or across it to mean this is an abbreviation. And as people wrote this LB bar or LB line down faster and faster and faster, this became the pound sign, the hash mark. So that's the mark. The fact that it's called the Octothorpe is entirely out of left field. It's weird. Bell Labs, which is part of AT&T, had to design a new telephone keypad. This is when we went from rotary dial telephones to push-button telephones. So they designed a system which had these two spare buttons. If you look at your phone, it'll have an asterisk or a star and a pound sign on it. And they needed a name for the pound sign. It's sometimes called the pound sign. It's sometimes called the number sign, sometimes called the hash mark. It has lots of different names, and no one of them was really agreed upon. And bizarrely enough, two different people who worked at Bell Labs claimed to have invented this word pretty much out of nowhere. Octo, because it has 8 points, and Thorpe for bizarre reasons. One was about an American athlete who had medals taken away from him at an early Olympic Games. His name was Jim Thorpe, and someone was trying to raise awareness of his case. So he said, let's call it the Octo Thorpe. So it is entirely, entirely bizarre, and yet it's about the most unambiguous way to refer to this symbol.
It's so funny that the mark itself has more fame, I guess, than Thorpe does at this point. Well, we're hearing a lot about these marks right now, learning some new stuff with our guest, Keith Houston, about the history and evolution of punctuation marks and typographical symbols. And we want to hear from you as well. Is there a punctuation mark that you've always been curious about, one that you wish would be used more often or maybe less often? Maybe you've got one of these typewriters kicking around with an interrobang on it. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about punctuation with Keith Houston. And you can join in our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Keith, yeah, we were talking about, you have this lovely Scottish accent, but you actually have a Wisconsin connection, right?
I do, yes. My wife's family live in Wisconsin. I'm afraid my Wisconsin geography is not brilliant, but they live in and around Black River Falls, which is, I think, close to Eau Claire.
That's
about right, yeah.
Right now.
Excellent. Well, she may be out there listening right now. Well, let's go to the phones first. We've got Alex on the line from Madison. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. Yes, I have a question about the earlier conversation regarding an irony mark. And I was wondering if the guests thought that perhaps one of the reasons that an irony mark hasn't arisen is because the very concept of irony is that some people are supposed to get it and some people are not. So maybe having an irony mark in an email that you forwarded around the office wouldn't necessarily convey the true sense, because there would be because a single meaning would be conveyed when maybe a different meaning was meant for different people.
Right. Good point. What do you think about that, Keith?
Yes. I think that certainly irony is saying one thing and meaning another, or saying one thing and not meaning it, basically. I agree that it's sometimes irony is most effective when it is very targeted, when only part of your audience gets the joke effectively. But I think that in those cases, you might choose not to use an irony mark. In fact, that's part of the danger, or part of the difficulty with an irony mark. If you have it there, you may choose to use it sincerely, meaning I've just written something that's ironic. You might choose to use it ironically and not mean, and not actually mean it. So you've maybe written something which is not ironic and use an irony mark to confuse people, or again, to joke about it. Or you may choose not to mean it, but be ironic anyway. And I think this sort of confusion of uses is maybe one of the reasons why it's very difficult to make it work.
All right. Thanks for the call, Alex. We'll go to the phones again with Kathy in Delafield. Kathy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you both. I'd I think that the term hashtag, it to me, it just appeared overnight, and it seems to be used so much. It seems to be overused. But I was waiting for the answer as to why did it just suddenly appear on the horizon? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, basically, one of the original, I think, is a guy named Chris Messina, who was working for Twitter, I believe, at the time, certainly was one of the very early adopters of Twitter. And the hashtag, or the hash mark, was already in use in another slightly more obscure messaging slash social network type service. And it meant a kind of channel, like, let's see, we're talking about baseball, then you would be in the hash baseball channel. And he imported it to Twitter, and it took off. It was initially a kind of an informal thing, but it was so widely used that Twitter then built it into the way that Twitter works, and hence the hashtag is now, it's bound up with Twitter in the same way that the at symbol is bound up with email, I think. That's pretty much why it just appeared out of nowhere.
I was going to say, speaking of repurposed symbols used in technology, that at sign, now first of all, before its current use, it's that A with the circle sort of around it. Seems like it should have a fancy name, but it's just the at symbol, that's it? That's all we got?
I have read recently that some people may be calling it the aspirand.
Oh.
So it's a bit, I guess it's an adaptation of ampersand. I quite like aspirand.
Aspirand. No one will ever know what you're talking about, though. That's the only problem.
I'll have a nice cup of aspirand tea, I think. Yeah, that sounds pretty good. But so how did that become, as the hashtag was to Twitter, how did the at symbol become the email thing?
Well, no one is really sure where the symbol itself came from. It may just be an abbreviation for a word beginning with A, a sort of medieval abbreviation for it. It started to be used to mean amphora or amphora, which is a kind of a Roman or Greek jug or vessel that was used to transport things. And from there, it took the meaning of, say, a number of items at a given price. So, you know, 5 apples at $1 each or something like that. And so it was useful enough in commercial circles that it made its way onto the typewriter keyboard. And it sat there, and if you had cause to use it, you used it. And if you didn't, you didn't. And when email was being invented, when someone basically conceptualized and wrote this email program, a guy called Ray Tomlinson, he needed a symbol for the addressing scheme. You know, I'm sending an email to a user at a given computer. And on his keyboard, which is derived from the typewriter keyboard, basically the only symbol that wasn't used for something else was the at symbol. So he chose it, and happily it had the right kind of meaning, you know, some user at computer. And again, it just took off from there. Email very, very quickly went on to become the biggest thing on the internet, on the sort of the young internet. And so, again, like the hashtag, overnight almost, it went from sort of obscurity to very mainstream usage.
You know, one of my favorites, both for the symbol itself and for the name, is the manicule. Can you tell us about the birth and the death, I guess, of the manicule?
The manicule looks like a pointing hand. It's funny. Most other marks are stylized in some way. They've evolved a long way from their roots, and so they like the ampersand, for example. It doesn't really look like the letters E and T anymore for the most part. But the manicule looks like a hand. That's what it is. It's just a pointing hand. This seemed to come about in the Renaissance, where readers were very engaged with their books. They wanted to leave their mark upon them. When they read something that was interesting, they wanted to mark it. They wanted to say, look at this. I should come back to this, or I should reread this. And often they drew little pointing hands, and these were called manicules. Then what happened was printing came along, and suddenly authors were able to use these little pointing hands as well. And the manicule kind of switched allegiances from readers to writers, in the same way that punctuation had in general, in fact. And it just sort of died out. The use of the manicule by the reader just kind of went away. I think maybe writing in the margins in general is something which is, mm-hmm. has died out to a degree, and the manicule was taken with it. So now it's become a kind of a symbol that you know a bit about typography or printing, and it's a bit of a cult mark, a bit like the interrobang or the pilcro. It shows that you know your stuff, and Yeah, it's now just a curiosity rather than a mark that you might use in everyday writing.
Of our standard arsenal of punctuation, the periods and commas and question marks, do you have a favorite or one that you feel is maybe redundant or doesn't do the job it should?
I'm not sure I have a favorite. I'm in the process of writing the follow-up to Shady Characters, and it turns out I use a lot of semicolons. I think people worry that the semicolon is going to become extinct. If I have anything to do with it, it won't. but yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, knowing the set of punctuation symbols that we have available to us, I try to use them all as correctly as I can. I'm not sure there's any one I would say is redundant necessarily. They all have their place.
Do you know anything about how it came to be that when we were trying to tactfully censor curse words that we ended up using a slew of punctuation marks instead?
Yeah, so I think basically dashes, ampersands, and periods have all been used to do this. I'm not entirely sure where it started, but where it really took off was in reporting of parliamentary proceedings in England, where it was actually illegal to report on parliamentary proceedings. So magazines would just censor the names of people taking mm-hmm. part in these debates, and that's really that seems to be where it really took off. It's also when the concept of the novel came about, and instead of going for very fanciful, idealistic characters, novelists tried to make it a bit more realistic. So Moll Flanders, for example, one of the first novels, has lots of dashes because it wants to make you think that the writer may be talking about real people and he doesn't want to offend them. So it was to do with realism as well, bizarrely enough. It was to heighten the sense of realism in a work of fiction.
Okay, last quickie question here. Would you have a favorite one coming on the horizon?
A favorite
punctuation mark that might be up and coming?
Oh, there's an irony mark that looks like a zigzag exclamation mark. It's Dutch. It's called the Irony Tekken, and I would love it if it succeeded. I think it looks great.
Excellent. Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We're talking to Keith Houston. He's a member, or he's the author, rather, of Shady Characters, The Secret Life of Punctuation Symbols and Other Typographical Marks.